Well, the first reaction is usually to the title, Mating in Captivity. Some people know exactly what I mean, and they understand immediately that we don't necessarily like to mate in captivity. And so then the next question is, so can desire be sustained in the long haul? Can you reconcile the domestic and the erotic in one relationship? Can you reconcile intimacy and sexuality with the same person for the long haul?
And those questions, they're at the heart of what Esther Perel's been studying for 30 years. Questions she explores on the TED stage.
When I was asked about fun activities and like my idea, I was looking at 750,000. I was asked about fun activities and like my ideal date, I said monetization and fluency in Japanese. I talked a lot about JavaScript.
Fluent in Japanese and JavaScript. That's hot.
That's super sexy.
That's sexy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe that wasn't the best way for me to introduce myself. But you know, the crazy thing is that even though I had foolishly copied and pasted from my resume, it didn't stop the dating services from matching me with other people, and it certainly didn't stop those people from asking me out on dates.
So how'd they go?
Yeah, I had some dates that were pretty rough. I was being set up with very, very orthodox rabbis, which was like a no-go from the get-go. People who were super interested in sports. There was being stuck with the check. There was another guy who was diminutive and ordered a lot of Long Island iced teas. And we were out doing karaoke on our first date. And he ran up on stage and sang a bunch of songs and then dedicated them to his girlfriend. And I was like, I have no
idea. There's actually a drive, a brain circuitry that developed millions of years ago that's devoted entirely to romantic love.
People have resisted thinking that romantic love actually is a brain system. They're scared that it'll break the magic. They want romantic love to be part of the supernatural.
But why can't that brain chemistry be kind of supernatural?
Well, on some level, I don't know. I'm a scientist. I put people in brain scanners. But, you know, when it actually happens to you, it can feel supernatural. I mean, why isn't it supernatural? Because it's housed in the brain. Why do we want to feel that it's supernatural? Because it feels so good.
Okay, so this brain system, it's kind of like a
sleeping cat. It can be awakened at any time.
Any time, any place. And that's partly because
as you grow up, you begin
this is the TED Radio Hour. Each week, groundbreaking TED Talks.
TED Talks.
TED.
TED.
Technology.
Entertainment.
Design.
Design. Is that really what it stands for? I've never known that.
Delivered at TED conferences around the world.
It's the gift of the human imagination.
We've had to believe in impossible things.
The true nature of reality beckons from just beyond.
Those talks, those ideas, adapted for radio. From NPR. I'm Guy Raz. When people meet you, when they ask you where you're from, what do you say?
I say I'm from Australia because I know exactly what they're trying to ask me, which is, where's that accent from? Where are you from? Why do you sound different?
This is Tan Lee. She lives in San Francisco.
And then they say, but where are you from originally? And then I say, I'm from Vietnam originally.
That's where she's from, but who she is begins with an early experience, a journey in her case.
So I remember a lot, actually. I remember bits and pieces, probably because of the fact that my father stayed behind in case we were captured and had to be cared for in prison.
Tan was 4 at the time. Her mom, her sister, her grandma were there too. They were all on a rickety boat with other refugees escaping the aftermath of the Vietnam War.
I do remember saying goodbye to my father. I remember crouching low in the water. I remember the bow of our boat dipping into the waves. I remember the darkness of the ocean. And I, of course, I remember that night after 5 days at sea, looking up and saying to my mum, "Wow, Mum, look at all the stars," because they were right up close in front of us. And then I heard screams all around us, and my mum said, "Oh, they're not stars, they're an oil rig." I didn't know what that was, but that just meant we were saved. And then I also remember the very first apple I tasted, given to me by the men on the oil rig. After so many days of not having a lot of water and not having much food at all, because we were rationing our food, we were just sitting around looking at them. Then they were throwing apples between each other. And the only thing we had in our mind was, what if we could have this apple? And then they decided to give us one. And I just remember biting into it, and just, it was just unbelievable.
How much of your, of who you are is wrapped up in that journey?
I would say a very large part of me is wrapped up, not so much just the journey, but it's the lessons that we've learned from that journey.
Our show this week is all about journeys, how we become who we are, how we got the identities we have. And we'll hear from TED speakers who all grapple with what it means to have many different identities. So let's start with Tan Lee's TED Talk.
After 3 months in a refugee camp, we landed in Melbourne. We settled in Footscray, a working-class suburb whose demographic is layers of immigrants. The smells from shop doors were from the rest of the world, and the snippets of halting English were exchanged between people who had one thing in common. They were starting again. My mother worked on farms, then on a car assembly line, working 6 days, double shifts. Somehow she found time to study English and gain IT qualifications. We were poor. All the dollars were allocated, and extra tuition in English and mathematics was budgeted for, regardless of what missed out, which was usually new clothes. 2 pairs of stockings for school, each to hide the holes in the other. A school uniform down to the ankles because it had to last for 6 years. And there were rare but searing chants of slit eye, and the occasional graffiti, "Asian, go home." Go home to where? Something stiffened inside me. There was a gathering of resolve and a quiet voice saying, "I will bypass you." My mother, my sister and I slept in the same bed. My mother was exhausted each night, but we told one another about our day and listened to the movements of my grandmother around the house. My mother suffered from nightmares all about the boat. And my job was to stay awake until her nightmares came so I could wake her. She opened a computer store, then studied to be a beautician and opened another business. And the women came with their stories about men who could not make the transition, angry and inflexible, and troubled children caught between two worlds. I lived in parallel worlds. In one, I was the classic Asian student, relentless in the demands I made on myself. In the other, I was enmeshed in lives that were precarious, tragically scarred by violence, drug abuse, and isolation. When I was a final year law student, I was chosen as the Young Australian of the Year. Tan Lee, anonymous Footscray resident, was now Tan Lee, refugee and social activist, invited to speak in venues she had never heard of and into homes whose existence she could never have imagined.
Do you remember when you started to feel like you belonged where you were?
That's a never-ending saga with me, I think. I've talked about feeling like an imposter, like a fraud. You'd think that at 20 years old, when I was named Young Australian of the Year, I would have felt like I belonged to Australia. And part of me did, but as I was sent from place to place to speak from, you know, one gathering to another. And I, of course, I remember being invited to a beautiful house in Melbourne. And I thought to myself, you know, this painting on this wall is so expensive. The cushions on the chair that I was sitting on must be so expensive compared to, you know, the entire outfit I was wearing at the time. And they were pouring expensive wine. I didn't know how to drink wine. I didn't know how to talk about it. I'm like, my goodness, this is crazy. Why am I here? I don't belong here.
Do you ever have moments where you do something or you say something or you think something and it just occurs to you that your identity is wrapped up in your experiences, in your mother and your grandmother and their experiences and where you are now?
Absolutely. I am absolutely 100% certain that I am a product of all of the things, because I even remember as early as walking down the gangway from the aeroplane when we first landed in Melbourne. And my mother was holding my sister and I in her hands, and she said, at the bottom of the steps, you're going to touch onto very special ground, and I want you to bend down and touch that ground. And I remember bending down and touching the ground with my sister. And we both looked up to my mom and we said, Mom, it doesn't feel very special. And my mom said, then make it special in your minds. And this is the thing. It's such an important symbol that we carried with us to have a life, to have a future, to have real aspirations that count for something. And so everything counted. This is just one of the layers that define who I am and my values, and I guess in many ways my sense of duty and responsibility to my parents, who gave up so much of their lives, their hopes, their dreams, their aspirations, gave all of that up so that my sister and I could have something that was meaningful.
Do you think about identity a lot? Is it something that is important in your life on a day-to-day basis?
I think it's it would be incorrect to say that I don't think about identity, because what I do and what I work on and who I am and my family, I mean, all of it is really centered around a sense of identity. I think, you know, once we lose our own sense of identity, we lose our own sense of integrity and who we are. So I think it's important to remember your own identity. And it doesn't necessarily have to be tied to a geographic location or what you do or your profession, but it's more about understanding who you are and what really drives you as a person.
Before I close, though, let me tell you about my grandmother. She grew up at a time when Confucianism was the social norm and the local Mandarin was the person who mattered. Life hadn't changed for centuries. Her father died soon after she was born. Her mother raised her alone. I was taking a shower in a hotel room in Sydney the moment she died, 600 miles away in Melbourne. I looked through the shower screen and saw her standing on the other side. I knew she had come to say goodbye. My mother phoned minutes later. A few days later, we went to a Buddhist temple in Footscray and sat around her casket. We told her stories and assured her that we were still with her. At midnight, the monk came and told us he had to close the casket. My mother asked us to feel her hand. She asked the monk, why is it that her hand is so warm and the rest of her is so cold? Because you have been holding it since this morning, he said. You have not let it go. If there is a sinew in our family, it runs through the women. Given who we were and how life had shaped us, we can now see that the men that might have come into our lives would have thwarted us. Defeat would have come too easily. Now I would like to have my own children, and I wonder about the boat. Who could ever wish it on their own? Yet I am afraid of privilege, of ease, of entitlement. Can I give them a bow in their lives, dipping bravely into each wave? The unperturbed and steady beat of the engine, the vast horizon that guarantees nothing. I don't know, but if I could give it and still see them safely through, I would.
Tan Lee. She's been living in San Francisco for the past 8 years. She runs a tech startup for a product that can read your mind. That is a whole nother TED Talk. Find it at TED.com. I'm Guy Raz. More on identities here on the TED Radio Hour in a moment from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And our show today is all about identities, the ones we inherit, the ones we choose, and how we become who we are. Tell me some of your identities.
I think I like being a father the best of all.
Yeah.
But being a husband comes pretty close. And then, you know, I have some real sense of investment in being American, being almost 50, being gay. They're all identities.
This is the writer Andrew Solomon, and he's spent a considerable amount of his life trying to understand identity, what it means for other people and what it means for himself. He described it in the opening of his TED Talk.
Even in purely non-religious terms, homosexuality represents a misuse of the sexual faculty. It is a pathetic little second-rate substitute for reality, a pitiable flight from life, and it deserves not to be deemed anything but a pernicious sickness. That's from Time magazine in 1966, when I was 3 years old. And last year, the President of the United States came out in favor of gay marriage. And my question is, how did we get from there to here? How did an illness become an identity? When I was perhaps 6 years old, I went to a shoe store with my mother and my brother, and at the end of buying our shoes, the salesman said to us that we could each have a balloon to take home. My brother wanted a red balloon, and I wanted a pink balloon. My mother said that she thought I'd really rather have a blue balloon, but I said that I definitely wanted the pink one, and she reminded me that my favorite color was blue. The fact that my favorite color now is blue, but I'm still gay, is evidence of both my mother's influence and its limits. When I was little, my mother used to say, "The love you have for your children is like no other feeling in the world. And until you have children, you don't know what it's like." And when I was little, I took it as the greatest compliment in the world that she would say that about parenting my brother and me. And when I was an adolescent, I thought, "But I'm gay, and so I probably can't have a family." And when she said it, it made me anxious. And after I came out of the closet, when she continued to say it, it made me furious. I said, "I'm gay. That's not the direction that I'm headed in, and I want you to stop saying that."
Later in life, Andrew actually became a father himself. And he started to wonder more and more about the question, what happens when some people see your identity as an illness? And so he decided to write a book about it. And he talked to over 300 parents, all with kids who were different, kids who were autistic or deaf or disabled in some way.
And I suddenly thought, most deaf children are born to hearing parents. Those hearing parents tend to try to cure them. Those deaf people discover community somehow in adolescence. Most gay people are born to straight parents. Those straight parents often want them to function in what they think of as the mainstream world, and those gay people have to discover identity later on. And I hatched the idea that there are really two kinds of identity. There are vertical identities, which are passed down generationally from parent to child. Those are things like ethnicity, frequently nationality, language, often religion. Those are things you have in common with your parents and with your children. And while some of them can be difficult, there's no attempt to cure them. There are these other identities which you have to learn from a peer group, and I call them horizontal identities because the peer group is the horizontal experience. And those identities, those horizontal identities, people have almost always tried to cure. And I wanted to look at what the process is through which people who have those identities come to a good relationship with them. One of the families I interviewed, Tom and Karen Robards, were taken aback when, as young and successful New Yorkers, their first child was diagnosed with Down syndrome. They thought the educational opportunities for him were not what they should be, and so they decided they would build a little center, two classrooms that they started with a few other parents to educate kids with DS. And over the years, that center grew into something called the Cook Center, where there are now thousands upon thousands of children with intellectual disabilities who are being taught. The Robards had a lot to do with that, and I said, do you regret it? Do you wish your child didn't have Down syndrome? Do you wish you'd never heard of it? And interestingly, his father said, well, for David, our son, I regret it, because for David, it's a difficult way to be in the world, and I'd like to give David an easier life. But I think if we lost everyone with Down syndrome, it would be a catastrophic loss. And Karen Robard said to me, I'm with Tom. For David, I would cure it in an instant to give him an easier life. But speaking for myself, well, I would never have believed 23 years ago when he was born that I could come to such a point. Speaking for myself, it's made me so much better and so much kinder and so much more purposeful in my whole life that speaking for myself, I wouldn't give it up for anything in the world.
What did you find when you were talking with these parents? How did they sort of help their children come to terms with their identity and not reject it, but embrace it?
A lot of the parents I interviewed had started off thinking, my child has this weird alien condition and I'm horrified. And then they felt that they saw their child growing up and they knew they had to help that child construct a positive image of himself. And with that awareness, they were able to get involved in the constructing of that positive image and to say to their child, I value you for who you are and you should value yourself for who you are too, because who you are is really pretty terrific.
The parents that you talk about, they're not just parents of children with their own identities, but they've developed identities as parents of children with these illnesses.
That's absolutely right. And those two identity groups need to be in communication and they need to inform each other, but they really are two separate groups. And for the parents, a lot of the time, what they desperately want to need is a sense of community with others who share the same condition they have. And for many of the conditions, the web has opened up networks of parents that have been incredibly helpful. For some of them, it really hasn't yet, and I hope that it will.
I decided to have children while I was working on this project. And many people were astonished and said, but how can you decide to have children in the midst of studying everything that can go wrong? And I said, I'm not studying everything that can go wrong. What I'm studying is how much love there can be, even when everything appears to be going wrong. The day after our son was born, the pediatrician came into the hospital room and said she was concerned. He wasn't extending his legs appropriately. She said that might mean that he had brain damage. Insofar as he was extending them, he was doing so asymmetrically, which he thought could mean that there was a tumor of some kind in action. And as she told me all of these things, I felt the very center of my being pouring out onto the floor. And I thought, here I had been working for years on a book about how much meaning people had found in the experience of parenting children who were disabled, and I didn't want to join their number. Because what I was encountering was an idea of illness, and like all parents since the dawn of time, I wanted to protect my child from illness. And I wanted also to protect myself from illness. And yet I knew from the work I had done that if he had any of the things we were about to start testing for, that those would ultimately be his identity, and if they were his identity, they would become my identity. We took him to the MRI machine, we took him to the CAT scanner, we took this day-old child and gave him over for an arterial blood draw. We felt helpless, and at the end of 5 hours, they said that his brain was completely clear and that he was by then extending his legs correctly. And when I asked the pediatrician what had been going on, she said she thought in the morning he had probably had a cramp. But I thought how my mother was right. I thought, the love you have for your children is unlike any other feeling in the world. And until you have children, you don't know what it feels like. During these 10 years, I had witnessed and learned the terrifying joy of unbearable responsibility, and I had come to see how it conquers everything else. And while I had sometimes thought the parents I was interviewing were fools, enslaving themselves to a lifetime's journey with their thankless children and trying to breed identity out of misery, I realized that day that my research had built me a plank and that I was ready to join them on their ship.
Most of us don't think about conditions, about deafness or Down syndrome as being an identity. And they are. I mean, these are thriving cultures.
They are thriving cultures, and it was quite exhilarating discovering those cultures. And what I felt in the end was, as long as you experience your condition as an illness, it's a prison. And once you experience it as an identity, it's the source of your freedom. And I think that insofar as we can treat illnesses as identities, we liberate people into experiences of great joy that would otherwise be closed to them. And I think, therefore, that there's a real moral imperative to give people the right to claim whatever quality they have as an identity. I think it's the only kind way to build a society.
Andrew Solomon. His book is called Far From the Tree, and his entire TED Talk can be found at ted.npr.org. So what happens when identity becomes a kind of a mental prison? Can you tell me, just list the places where you have lived?
I was born in Strasbourg in France. Afterwards, my parents got separated and I came to Turkey, to Ankara. After that, we lived in Amman, Jordan, in Cologne, Germany, back to Ankara.
This is Elif Shafak. She's a novelist who writes in Turkish and in English.
In my early 20s, I came to Istanbul because I thought the city called me. After many years in Istanbul, I came to Boston, Michigan, Arizona. Right now, I'm commuting between London and Istanbul.
Wow. If someone were to say to you, what's your identity or your identities, what would you say?
It's a question that I try to avoid, to be honest, because I'm not very happy with the word identity, at least the way it's being used. We always talk about identity, we fight for identity, sometimes we kill for identity, but why is that? Why can't we talk about belongings, multiple belongings?
Which is just what Elif Shafak does on the TED stage.
I was raised as a single child by a single mother. Now, in the early 1970s in Ankara, that was a bit unusual. Our neighborhood was full of large families where fathers were the heads of households. So I grew up seeing my mother as a divorcee in a patriarchal environment.
In fact, I grew up observing two different kinds of womanhood. On the one hand was my mother, a well-educated, secular, modern, westernized Turkish woman. On the other hand was my grandmother, who also took care of me and was more spiritual, less educated, and definitely less rational. This was a woman who read Coffee Grounds to see the future and melted lead into mysterious shapes to fend off the evil eye. Many people visited my grandmother, people with severe acne on their faces or warts on their hands. Each time, my grandmother would utter some words in Arabic, take a red apple, and stab it with as many rose thorns as the number of warts she wanted to remove. Then, one by one, she would encircle these thorns with dark ink. A week later, the patient would come back for a follow-up examination. Now, I'm aware that I should not be saying such things in front of an audience of scholars and scientists, but the truth is, of all the people who visited my grandmother for their skin conditions, I did not see anyone go back unhappy or unhealed. From her, I learned, amongst many other things, one very precious lesson, that if you want to destroy something in this life, be it an acne, a blemish, or the human soul, all you need to do is to surround it with thick walls. It will dry up inside. Now, we all live in some kind of a social and cultural circle. We're born into a certain family, nation, class. But if we have no connection whatsoever with the worlds beyond the one we take for granted, then we too run the risk of drying up inside.
You know, I love that idea that, you know, we can actually become encircled by our identity, that it can be so stifling that something inside of us can die.
Absolutely. It can reduce us, and maybe we won't be aware of this because we think it's natural, because we think it's the way things should be. Just to give an example, I mean, my generation, we grew up with lots of fears, the fear of the other, the fear of our neighbors. We thought we were surrounded by enemies, you know, the Greeks, the Bulgarians, the Serbians, the Arabs, the Russians. And then when you take a step back, how dangerous that fear is, because it prevents you from really connecting to other people. And when you can't connect to other people, the more fear you have. It's a vicious circle. And identity is a big question for us Turks, because we're always debating this, you know, who are we? Are we part of Europe? Are we part of Middle East? Are we Eastern? Are we Western? Are we a threshold country? Is there such a thing? Is it possible? So it's a huge dilemma.
My mother became a diplomat. So from this small, superstitious, middle-class neighborhood of my grandmother, I was zoomed into this posh international school where I was the only Turk. We were like a mini United Nations, which was fun, except whenever something negative with regards to a nation or religion took place, the child who represented it was mocked. I also had my first taste of cultural stereotypes there. The other children asked me about the movie Midnight Express, which I had not seen. They inquired how many cigarettes a day I smoked, because they thought all Turks were heavy smokers. And they wondered at what age I would start covering my hair. I came to learn that these were the three main stereotypes about my country: politics, cigarettes, and the veil. When my first novel written in English came out in America, I heard an interesting remark from a literary critic. "I liked your book," he said, "but I wish you had written it differently." I asked him what he meant by that. He said, "Well, look at it. There's so many Spanish, American, Hispanic characters in it, but there's only one Turkish character, and it's a man." Now, the novel took place on a university campus in Boston, so to me, it was normal that there be more international characters in it than Turkish characters, but I understood what my critic was looking for. He wanted to see the manifestation of my identity. He was looking for a Turkish woman in the book because I happened to be one. What I experienced as a child in that school in Madrid is happening in the literary world today. Writers are not seen as creative individuals on their own, but as the representatives of their respective cultures.
In a moment, why Elif Shafak is actually two different writers, depending on which language she chooses. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Hey, if you like movies, TV shows, books, music, and more, check out the Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. It's a smart weekly discussion about all those things. You can find NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour on iTunes under podcasts. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And our program this week is about identities. It's a word that novelist Elif Shafak, who is Turkish by birth and culture, it's a word that she does not like.
We often talk about how stories change the world, but we should also see how the world of identity politics affects the way stories are being circulated, read, and reviewed. Many authors feel this pressure, but non-Western authors feel it more heavily. If you're a woman writer from the Muslim world, like me, then you are expected to write the stories of Muslim women, and preferably the unhappy stories of unhappy Muslim women. You're expected to write informative, poignant, and characteristic stories and leave the experimental and avant-garde to your Western colleagues.
Did that surprise you, that people wanted you to write from one narrow voice?
It did surprise me at the time. I mean, but it doesn't only come from the, you know, Western world or Western literary market. I also hear lots of similar comments from Turkish people. For instance, with all the good intentions, they say, you know, you should represent Turkish women, that not all Muslim women are like this or like that. So they want to attribute a function to me this time, which I find very dangerous. If a writer believes in such missions, such roles, then, you know, literature becomes something else. I can't represent anything other than myself, because I believe our imagination is bigger than our identity.
I mean, there are things, though, about identity that are also magical, right? Like your grandmother's mysticism, mm-hmm. or a sidewalk or a street corner in Istanbul, or a tradition that you grew up with.
Yes. And I think it's very beautiful that we feel connected, you know, to the places we grew up in. So, you know, that cultural belonging is something that I have a positive feeling towards. Cultural belongings are more fluid. They're made of water, you know, and they can flow in different directions. But when we start saying, are you one of us? Are you one of them? Then the nature of the talk changes.
In my mid-20s, I moved to Istanbul, the city I adore. I lived in a very vibrant, diverse neighborhood where I wrote several of my novels. I was in Istanbul when the earthquake hit in 1999. When I ran out of the building at 3 in the morning, I saw something that stopped me in my tracks. There was the local grocer there, a grumpy old man who didn't sell alcohol and didn't speak to marginals. He was sitting next to a transvestite with black, long black wig and mascara running down her cheeks. I watched a man open a pack of cigarettes with trembling hands and offer one to her. And that is the image of the night of earthquake in my mind today. A conservative grocer and a crying transvestite smoking together on the sidewalk. On the face of death and destruction, our mundane differences evaporated, and we all became one, even for a few hours. But I've always believed that stories, too, have a similar effect on us. I'm not saying that fiction has the magnitude of an earthquake, but when we are reading a good novel, we leave our small, cozy apartments behind, go out into the night alone, and start getting to know people we had never met before, and perhaps had even been biased against.
I love that way of looking at a novel, because it's so true. And I mean, you write in Turkish and in English, and I wonder whether you almost become a different person depending on the language you're writing in.
That's a beautiful question. It's a very difficult question in a way, but I think you're right in the sense that maybe the best position for a writer, at least again for myself, is what I call as the threshold or the in-between them, the limbo. You know, you're an insider and at the same time you're an outsider. There's a very, very ambivalent, thin area there that I cherish. When you're too much inside something, you can't see it. You know, the proportions change. But when you're too much disconnected from something, you can't see it either. And I realize maybe writing in English helps me situate myself. It gives me a certain distance, if you will, but not too much of a distance.
Perhaps that elusive mid-space is what writers and artists need most. In the end, stories move like whirling dervishes, drawing circles beyond circles. They connect all humanity, regardless of identity politics, and that is the good news. And I would like to finish with an old Sufi poem. Come, let us be friends for once. Let us make life easy on us. Let us be lovers and loved ones. The earth shall be left to no one. Thank you.
Elif Shafak, she's a writer based in London. You can hear her entire talk at TED.com. You are in Santa Barbara right now, right?
I am. That's right.
This is the writer Pico Iyer, which is your home now, kind of, sort of?
For this week, yes. My official home, where I never actually spend any time. But yes, it's my address on my tax forms, at least.
And for Pico, trying to figure out some of the biggest questions about identity starts with just one question. Where do you come from?
It's such a simple question, but these days, of course, simple questions bring ever more complicated answers. People are always asking me where I come from, and they're expecting me to say India, and they're absolutely right insofar as 100% of my blood and ancestry does come from India, except I've never lived one day of my life there. I can't speak even one word of its more than 22,000 dialects, so I don't think I've really earned the right to call myself an Indian. And if where do you come from means where were you born and raised and educated, then I'm entirely of that funny little country known as England. Except I left England as soon as I completed my undergraduate education, and all the time I was growing up, I was the only kid in all my classes who didn't begin to look like the classic English heroes represented in our textbooks. And if where do you come from means where do you pay your taxes, where do you see your doctor and your dentist, then I'm very much of the United States, and I have been for 48 years now, since I was a really small child. Except for many of those years, I've had to carry around this funny little pink card with green lines running through my face, identifying me as a permanent alien. I do actually feel more alien the longer I live there. And if where do you come from means which place goes deepest inside you, and where do you try to spend most of your time, then I'm Japanese, because I've been living as much as I can for the last 25 years in Japan, except all of those years I've been there on a tourist visa, and I'm fairly sure not many Japanese would want to consider me one of them. And I say all this just to stress how very old-fashioned and straightforward my background is.
When you were a kid in the U.S., you know, with this British accent and, you know, you looked Indian, did you feel like you didn't really know who you were?
Well, I felt luckier than that. I felt that I have a lot of choices. And I think being a part of many places, but not entirely of any one of them, is a terrific emancipation. And it means that even if I'm in North Korea or Paraguay tomorrow, I'm no more foreign than when I'm in India or California or England. And I think when I was a little kid, I thought, well, it's an advantage that I have more choices at my disposal than many people do, and that they can't fit me into any category. But what I didn't expect or realize then, when I was a little kid growing up in the 60s, was that very quickly, within maybe 30 years, somebody like myself would become almost the norm. When I go to Hong Kong or Sydney or Vancouver, most of the kids I meet are much more international and multicultural than I am. And they have one home associated with their parents, but another associated with their partners, a third connected maybe with the place where they happen to be, a fourth connected with the place they dream of being, and many more. And their whole life will be spent taking pieces of many different places and putting them together into a stained glass whole. home for them is really a work in progress. It's like a project on which they're constantly adding upgrades and improvements and corrections. And for more and more of us, home has really less to do with a piece of soil than, you could say, with a piece of soul. If somebody suddenly asks me, "Where's your home?" I think about my sweetheart or my closest friends or the songs that travel with me wherever I happen to be. Those are our much deeper homes. You know, I remember as a little boy, my parents would sometimes take me to a museum, and I would look at a 19th century Japanese painting, and something in it would pierce me with this sense of familiarity, and I would look at this scene from a culture that I have nothing to do with, and I would feel I recognize that much better than the street on which I was born or the house in which I keep all my things.
Why do you think you felt you understood it, that it resonated with you in such a visceral way?
I can't explain it, and that's what I trust about it. You know, I have most faith in those things that are beyond my understanding. And I think most of us have these secret homes, as it were. But the beauty of the global moment is that we can actually live in these secret homes. The number of people living in countries not their own now comes to 220 million. Already, we represent the fifth largest nation on Earth. And in fact, in Canada's largest city, Toronto, the average resident today is what used to be called a foreigner, somebody born in a very different country. For the fortunate among us, I think the age of movement brings exhilarating new possibilities. Certainly when I'm traveling, especially to the major cities of the world, the typical person I meet today will be, let's say, a half Korean, half German young woman living in Paris. And as soon as she meets a half Thai, half Canadian young guy from Edinburgh, she recognizes him as kin. She realizes that she probably has much more in common with him than with anybody entirely of Korea or entirely of Germany. They become friends. They fall in love. They move to New York City. And the little girl who arises out of their union will, of course, be not Korean or German or French or Thai or Scotch or Canadian or even American, but a wonderful and constantly evolving mix of all those places. And potentially, everything about the way that young woman dreams about the world, writes about the world, thinks about the world, could be something different.
Is your home where you find your identity, or is your identity your home?
Wow, that's a beautiful question. And I would say that my home is where I find my identity, where I create my identity, which is an ongoing phenomenon. So, for example, next week I'm going to Iran, and maybe that will have an important effect on my life and my thinking and my imagination, and that will become part of the collage that is my home.
Do you ever wonder if the more identity becomes something that's not the way we've traditionally defined it, that there's almost a possibility that we could lose something?
I think so. I mean, it's certainly, as I say, it's posing a question to us that we have to answer, that our grandparents didn't even have to think about. It's almost like being lost in one of those long, grey, anonymous passageways in an airport where you don't belong to either the place you've left or the place you're about to arrive in, and you feel completely lost. And I sometimes will meet people who have grown up in the same house where their parents and their grandparents grew up in and have this wonderful sense of rootedness. And those of us who don't inherit those kind of circumstances have to create our own equivalent versions. And I'd always felt this way, but it really came home to me, as it were, some years ago when I was climbing up the stairs in my parents' house in California. And I looked through the living room windows, and I saw that we were encircled by 70-foot flames, one of those wildfires that regularly tear through the hills of California and many other such places. And 3 hours later, that fire had reduced my home and every last thing in it, except for me, to ash. And when I woke up the next morning, I was sleeping on a friend's floor. The only thing I had in the world was a toothbrush I'd just bought from an all-night supermarket. Of course, if anybody asked me then, where is your home, I literally couldn't point to any physical construction.
That must have been devastating.
It was difficult at first, and it took a little while to find my feet again. But at the same time, I think it underlined what I had always felt, which is just that my home had to be something inside me, rather than that any physical piece of property. And in those circumstances, it's really important to have some home inside you that's been there all along that will guide you into the next phase of your life.
And 8 months after my house burnt down, I ran into a friend who taught at a local high school. And he said, I've got the perfect place for you. Actually, it's a Catholic hermitage. So I got in my car and I drove 3 hours north along the coast, and the roads grew emptier. And then I turned onto an even narrower path up to the top of a mountain. And when I got out of my car, the whole place was absolutely silent, but the silence wasn't an absence of noise. It was really a presence of a kind of energy. And at my feet was the great still blue plate of the Pacific Ocean. And I went down to the room in which I was to be sleeping, and I sat down and I began to write and write and write. And by the time I got up, 4 hours had passed. Night had fallen. It was really all the freedom I know when I'm traveling, but it also profoundly felt like coming home. And I began to think that something in me had really been crying out for stillness, but of course I couldn't hear it because I was running around so much. I was like some crazy guy who puts on a blindfold and then complains that he can't see a thing. It's only by stopping movement that you can see where to go. And it's only by stepping out of your life and the world that you can see what you most deeply care about and find a home. And home, in the end, is of course not just the place where you sleep. It's the place where you stand. Thank you.
Writer Pico Iyer. Check out his full talk at ted.npr.org. Hey, thanks for listening to our show about identity this week. If you missed any of it, or you want to hear more, or you want to find out more about who was on it, you can visit ted.npr.org. You can also find many more TED Talks at ted.com, and you can download this program through iTunes or through the NPR smartphone app. Our program was produced by Jeff Rogers, Brent Bachman, Megan Kane, Neva Grant, and Sanaz Meshkinpour, with help from Portia Robertson-Migas and Eric Newsom. Thanks to our partners at TED, Chris Anderson, June Cohen, Darren Triff, and Janet Lee. I'm Guy Raz. You've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading on the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I got to be myself, yeah. I can't be nobody else. Hey, if you have a moment, check out another NPR podcast. It's called Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's a smart weekly discussion about the latest movies and TV shows, books, music, and more. You can find NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour on iTunes under podcasts.
This is Philosophy Bites with me, David Edmonds.
And me, Nigel Warburton.
Philosophy Bites is available at www.philosophybites.com.
Philosophy Bites is made in association with the Institute of Philosophy.
In a few countries, same-sex marriage exists. In many, it is illegal. But in some jurisdictions, though members of the same sex can't get married, they can have what's called a civil partnership. Is this discriminatory? Isn't civil partnership, to all intents and purposes, identical to marriage? Is there any philosophical, any rational reason to prohibit people of the same sex from tying the marriage knot? Les Green is a law professor at Oxford University.
Les Green, Welcome to Philosophy Bites.
Thank you.
The topic we're going to focus on is same-sex marriage. Now, this is often discussed as gay marriage. Is that a synonymous term?
No, it's not a synonymous term. Ordinarily, of course, people of the same sex who enter a marriage are both homosexuals and usually homosexuals of the same sex, but they needn't be. In our present regime, a gay man can marry a lesbian or a gay man can marry a straight woman. And in our civil partnership regime, two straight men can enter a civil partnership. I think if you stand back and look at all that package, you'd see there's something rather odd about the way we've organized it.
Well, that's the way UK law is at the moment. But what's the philosophical issue here?
Well, I think there are a cluster of philosophic issues. One of them has to do with the nature or definition or meaning of marriage. That's kind of a conceptual issue, I suppose. And then there's a moral issue. There's a question of what we owe people who would flourish best in a conjugal relationship of the same sex.
Well, let's start with the marriage issue. What is marriage? What do you understand by marriage?
Well, marriage has been historically a whole range of things. If I had to have a quick definition, I'd say it was something like a conjugal relation of two or more people who recognize special obligations to each other and has entered voluntarily and intended to be, if not permanent, at least indefinite. I say two or more because, of course, historically there have been marriages that were plural. King Solomon, of course, everyone remembers, had 700 wives. Don't know how he had the time for that. And we have things like child marriages, we have morganatic marriages. These are all well within the semantic range of marriage. So the notion that there is one thing that marriage is now and has been is actually a serious mistake about the conceptual structure of, as we have it.
Well, just because lots of things are called marriages doesn't mean they all merit the commendatory term marriage, as it were. There's a sense in which to call something a marriage is to elevate it above other kinds of contract.
Yeah, we tend to think that marriage is special in a variety of ways, and of course it is. I mean, the content of the obligations marriage has are different to other forms of contract, but it is a contract at the end of the day. What makes it special is the character of the interests that are protected by that arrangement. And I think these interests, probably most of the people think these interests are among the most important interests we have. Our interest in intimacy and continuity of relationships, if there are children, a stable environment to raise children, security of property, common social forms by which we interact. These are the things that make marriage valuable. And they don't vary by the sex of the people in the marriage.
And yet, friendship has many of those qualities. Obviously, it doesn't typically include having children. And there's an overlap between friendship and marriage, hopefully, as well. But we don't tend to legislate for friendship.
No, friendship is just subject to the ordinary laws. What we do in the case of marriage is we take a kind of friendship, a very special one that has a conjugal element and a kind of indeterminacy and an intensity, and we try to support it. There is no clear borderline, of course, between friendship and marriage. And as you said yourself, a good marriage is also a friendship. It's also true in law that a marriage need not be more than a friendship. There's no legal requirement, contrary to the common belief, that people in marriage have sex at all, let alone any particular kind of sex. So our worry that there isn't a bright enough line is, I think, a bit misplaced. Like many things, marriage has central cases and less central cases. But the centrality, I don't think, has anything to do with the role of sex.
So where do you stand on same-sex marriage? Do you think it's something which ought to be instantiated in law and open to more than two partners as well?
Well, let's start with the first part. Yes, it ought to be legally protected because there are no good reasons for distinguishing them, although they are different. When we think about how we support relationships in law, we don't need to show that they're identical to show that they deserve the same treatment. We need to show that they're good enough that the reasons that apply in one case apply to the other. And I'm pretty confident that that's true in the case of same-sex marriage. Plural marriage is more complicated. J.S. Mill famously pointed out that much of what we call polygamy is really kind of a harem-like relationship in which one man has, sometimes owns, a number of wives. That was King Solomon's approach. And there are objections to that form of plural relationship that are distributive in character. I think those are plausible objections. So I think we have to be a little bit cautious about extending it beyond two. As it happens, most people want to live in binary relations with another person. If you're saying, you know, is it conceivable that some of these triples or quadruples could instantiate the same goods? Of course it's possible, and I'm sure some of them do.
Well, many people will say, look, it's obvious that the essence of marriage is that it's a union between a man and a woman. And they might not say that simply for religious reasons. They may feel there's something biological there too.
Well, there is something biological. Namely, there's a biological distinction between the two people. The question is whether there's any moral significance to that fact. So nobody is denying the statistically standard, typical, ordinary case of a marriage is one man and one woman. And it will always be so under any regime. Our best estimates are there are something less than 2% of the population are significantly gay that they would enter this. But one thing we have to bear in mind is whether or not we need to provide for marriage at all. So we could imagine a world without marriage. If we provide it for some people, it seems to me a plausible argument in terms of fairness that we should provide it for other people similarly situated, unless there's a morally significant difference. And it's no good just saying, well, look, there is a difference because some have men and women and some have men and men. We need to show the moral significance of that difference.
Well, one argument often used is that same-sex marriages don't allow for the possibility of procreation without bringing in either sperm or eggs from another source.
Yeah, for now, that's still true. It's also true, unhappily, for that argument of many other kinds of marriages. Sterile marriages, marriages among the elderly, don't allow for procreation in that sense. But anyway, suppose that we're wrong. We still need some clarity about what the value of procreation is. And I think there's a certain amount of fogginess around this, certainly in the public debate. I mean, you might think that there's a value, and this strikes me as plausible, of people raising children, the intimate relations between parents and child. I find it much harder to think there's a special moral value in those people raising children who share genetic material from both of those parents and just those parents. It's hard to see what's good about that. It's easy to see what's good about child rearing, but many same-sex couples are already rearing children.
Well, one worry that some opponents of same-sex marriage have is that it will license far more child rearing by gay couples, and there's an argument used by some people that this is then modelling homosexuality as a normal relationship, and if you're somehow morally opposed to homosexuality, you'll see this as actually an evil.
Let me just be clear about one thing. Homosexuality is, of course, a normal relationship. It's one of the normal human variants of sexuality. But look, it's perfectly possible that under a more liberal marriage regime, more gay people will marry and there'll be more children raised in those relationships than there are now. In this country and in most countries, we distinguish between adoption rights and marriage rights. The question of same-sex adoption is not now on the table here or in the United States. It's been settled. Even if you thought that there was something suboptimal or deficient or missing in a same-sex couple raising children, we would need another step to show that that was a powerful enough argument to deny those people the right to marry. Think about divorce. There's actually pretty good empirical evidence that children of divorce do a bit less well than children in intact marriages. But I think it would be puzzling to argue that adults' right to marry or to leave a marriage should be constrained by their prospects of raising children well. It's not merely, if it is true, same-sex couples that have a unique or unusual child-rearing arrangement. That's true also of interracial couples. It's true of couples in which there are vast religious and political differences. It's also true of couples that are just angry with each other. And yet we don't think any of these are reasons for limiting their power to marry, let alone limiting their power to exit or remarry.
So does that mean that the main argument for same-sex marriage that you're using is one of consistency?
Consistency is, I think, the most important argument for where we stand now. We already have marriage for some. We have no good reason for excluding other people from it.